to the Solari Food Series audio cast. This is your host, Pete Kennedy. Catherine Austin Fitz, the owner of Solari, has said, "What good is having assets if you don't have an army to protect them?" Well, part of your army should be the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. Launched on Independence Day 2007, for the last 14 years, FTCLDF has been protecting and establishing the rights of small farmers and local artisans to produce nutritious foods and the rights of consumers to have access to those foods. The current upheaval in our food system, FTCLDF's work is more important than ever. Catherine has generously made FTCLDF the beneficiary of donations to its Take Action crowdfund for the first quarter of 2021. So I thought it was appropriate today to have Alexia Kuwiec on as our guest. Alexia is the executive director of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund. And we're going to talk about the current work of FTCLDF and why it's worthy of your support. So, Alexia, welcome to the Solari Food Series audiocast.
Thank you, Pete. And I just want to say thank you to Solari for their support, for Catherine Fitz's support, and for having us on today. It's a great opportunity, and we're just so grateful to be able to reach readers and watchers, those that follow Solari.com, and introduce ourselves. My name is Alexia Kuwiec, and like Pete said, I am the executive director of the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund.
Okay, so let's start off with the core of FTCLDF's work. What is the mission of the organization?
Yeah, thanks. The mission itself is protecting, defending, and broadening the rights and viability of individual farmers, artisanal food producers, and their consumers. So essentially trying to support small farms and food producers in getting food directly to the consumers, to engage in direct commerce between farmers and their consumers.
Right. And I'd say there's kind of a short-term goal and a long-term goal of the Legal Defense Fund. I think the short-term is just creating the most favorable regulatory climate possible on a day-to-day basis, with more of the long-term goal just establishing the right of all people to obtain the food of their choice from the source of their choice. I think whether that source is regulated or not. So just, expand a little bit on the, just some of the things FTCLDF does in support of its mission.
Yeah, thank you. And yes, I would agree that we have that kind of short-term, long-term goal. In the short-term, I would add, so we are providing direct legal representation to our members when they are struggling with these obstacles to get food directly to consumers. I think the neat thing about this organization, as opposed to others that are supporting small sustainable farms, is that we provide the direct legal support to our members, and we engage in policy work to try to make the regulatory system more favorable and supportive of small farms and food producers, like you mentioned, Pete. So we're providing legal support on a day-to-day basis. We are trying to make the regulatory scheme more favorable in terms of policy, very often at the state and local level. And then longer term, we'd like to see, broader choice be part of it. Do you want me to get into details now in terms of more that we do for the...
Well, yeah, I think, just what you were talking about, the day-to-day work. If there are any other organizations that just work day-to-day with farmers, there are not many. There's some other organizations that do some great work in the area of food and food rights, but I think they more have, take particular cases and just try and litigate those cases. They don't necessarily provide a resource for someone who just has a question about their day-to-day operation. So, let's get into the, day-to-day work. I mean, one thing, give you an idea what these farmers face, and this impacts the work we do, obviously. I was just going over the possible visits or inspections they can get from agencies at the local, state, and federal level. Yeah, at the local level, could be the county health department, could be the zoning department, could be the Board of Animal Control. Some states, like in California, have their own county department of agriculture. And if things progress the wrong way, it could be just the county or city board of commissioners. At the state level, you're dealing with the Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, Environmental Protection, say the Bureau of Labor, maybe with an internship program on the farm. And again, if you get far enough, you're looking at the Attorney General, or maybe in a state like Florida, the Division of Administrative Hearings. And then at the federal level, yeah, you've got USDA, you've got FDA, you've got EPA. For maybe some farmers out west, you might have Department of Interior with Bureau of Land Management. And if it gets far enough, Department of Justice. So you're looking at, quite a few obstacles for the farmers in the way. And the Legal Defense Fund tries to, shield them best they can in their day-to-day operation. So if you could get a little bit into the day-to-day work of the organization.
Sure, absolutely. And first, I'll just respond to what you've laid out, because what you've just said is why it's so difficult for a small producer, right? So you've got a couple of dairy cows, maybe some meat animals, maybe some vegetables, and you've got to deal with all those agencies that you just listed, right? And it's really overwhelming for someone who really just wants to produce healthy local food and get it directly to the consumer, right? So what we do on a daily basis, I'll start with responding to all of those agency comments, which is yes, we are consulting with folks on all of those issues. So we very regularly will get questions on the laws concerning raw dairy, on meat slaughter and processing, on poultry processing. We seem to be getting more and more questions on cottage food issues, and then on a regular basis are dealing with land use issues and zoning issues. But in addition to the consulting on those things, we will get involved when there is an agency problem. We will provide that representation. So one example, you just said something about, you know, the local animal control officers. We've had an awful lot of cases in the last year where they've shown up at a farm and complained either about livestock guard dogs or complained about the care of animals that are farm animals, you know, and wanting to confiscate or feeling like there's a problem with how the animals are being raised. And so that is one agency. We won't just consult with the member. We'll get involved. We'll contact the agency. We'll try to walk the member through that administrative process. Sometimes that ends up in an actual administrative agency hearing, and we will walk members through. We will often represent them in those agency hearings. So we will provide individual case legal representation on a case-by-case basis, in addition to simply consulting with our members. And I'll just say, I do think that's one of the things that makes the organization unique, is you have people working on policy, I think, and you have some education out there, but the individual who's struggling today because FSIS is at their farm gate, we will help them through that inspection process. I don't know of anyone else that does that, right?
Yeah, just an important aspect of Legal Defense Fund's work is leveling the playing field, mm-hmm. just for small producers. I mean, when we started in 2007, at least in our area of work, we heard of more cases where you get a government agency that would sometimes drag farmers through both administrative and judicial hearings, trying to deplete them of their resources. And what we can do if the issue is important enough is they're not going to be depleted of resources that will go toward legal fees. You know, we can take that. Right. They still have their farming business. But and there are just some times where the department will take a position, maybe just a hostile position towards a producer. And then when they find out the producer has an attorney, it doesn't always work that way, but sometimes the department will back off a little bit. So that's just a major part of the work the Legal Defense Fund does. And I think at least in some states where we've worked quite a bit, I mean, some states were familiar with the attorneys who might be working for the Department of Agriculture. So there's
right.
just a chance because of the familiarity, the experience the attorneys have had in the work of getting a good result without having to go to some kind of hearing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so talk about, yeah, just some of the, one of the things the organization does is it offers contractual advice. So Right. Yeah, if you could get into—
Yeah, I wanted to touch on that.
Different contracts.
Mm-hmm, thank you. Yeah, so in addition to just the consultations, another thing we do very regularly on a daily basis is to draft contracts or agreement that producers can use with their consumers as a way to provide the locally produced food. I don't want to say a way around the regulation, but a way to comply with the law, but still allow the producer to get food directly to the consumer. So the biggest example, and I think goes all the way back to the founding of the organization, Pete, you know probably better than I on that, is the dairy herd share agreements. And so those are, in a lot of states, perfectly lawful for a producer to sell some of the shares of a dairy animal or a dairy herd. And then each of the share owners receive a portion of the product, of the production in a given week of that raw milk product. So at the federal level, it is unlawful to distribute or sell raw milk or raw milk products. At the state level, some states allow on-farm, some states will allow certain sales of raw milk, and some states will prohibit it. So we work with members to come up with these herd share agreements that allow end consumers to become part owners and lawfully obtain raw milk, which of course, so many of our members and consumers realize the health benefits to that. We will also enter into dairy services contracts, which means not only am I as a raw milk consumer getting a portion of the milk from the part of the herd that I own, but I can pay the producer to then turn in that milk product to turn it into another product. So I can pay a producer to make cheese or butter with my product, my portion of that raw milk. And so we will draft those agreements on a pretty regular basis as well. And we've been much more active lately, I would say, in meat and meat share agreements. And so what I mean by that also is, you know, the general rule is that for meat to be sold, you have to take it to a USDA or a state inspected facility. But if you can sell a live owner and have an animal brought to a custom slaughter facility, that is one way that a smaller producer can provide that meat to the customers. So we have been involved in contractual relations or, you know, drafting contracts with a bill of sale so producers can sell live animals or a portion of a live herd to an individual that can be custom processed and not brought to a USDA or state inspection facility. And this last one on the meat processing and slaughter, how it works in every state is different, but we do work with our members. And what I will say about it is this one is so important right now because, you know, this country is really going through a meat processing crisis, right? I mean, I was just reviewing some information the other day, Pete, that in February of 2020, even the USDA came out with a report talking about how consolidated the meat supply is. And then the very next month, all these plants shut down because of COVID and like there was no meat available, right? The problem has existed for a really long time in terms of smaller producers not getting into these plants, but it's been made that much worse during COVID. And so finding some opportunity for a small producer to produce meat and get it into the hands of the consumer without having to wait 3 years to get into a processing facility is so important to them. And we hear from our members, this was really their top priority when we did a survey last year, helping them get meat directly to consumers.
Right. I think one of the things we find out in the day-to-day work that a lot of times the law itself isn't as important as the agency's interpretation of the law.
Right.
So, yeah, just on some of these states with the herd share agreements, just some states the agency will fight back. It's difficult to have them. Other states, they will. I mean, in some of these states, we pursued, I guess, what I'd call the Monsanto strategy. Like they used to flood the fields with GMO, and we just tried to flood the state with herd share contracts. So it would be more and more difficult for them to put the genie back in the bottle. But the, yeah, it's, the advantage the attorneys have that work on day-to-day is they know how far I think they can push the envelope on these things. And it's sometimes just a matter of what can they do to just shift the controlling law. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got these, say with a raw milk, you've got this prohibition, the controlling law is dairy law. So if you give someone an ownership interest, you've shifted the controlling law from dairy law to property law, mm-hmm. and they're able to, yeah, provide milk. And I think with the dairy services contracts, we've worked with licensed farmers who can only provide raw milk and raw cheese to their customers. And foods like butter and cream are illegal. And it's mainly, you know, it's not a safety regulation. It's protecting the dairy processing industry. So this is a way to keep them in compliance with the law, but shift the law, controlling law, from dairy to property.
Yeah, that's well said.
But you also, yeah, we not only work with farmers, you know, talk about some of the day-to-day work with homesteaders on, yeah, their issues.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, we have homesteader members, which means, of course, they just want to grow food for their own use and their own purposes, not for sale, right? To support their own families, to live off the land. And it's fascinated me how common it is for a state or local agency to get involved and sort of object to that. So for example, it could be property, it could be a zoning issue where somebody is raising animals so that they could do their own slaughter and processing of meat. And, you know, somebody decides that the zoning of the property is not accurate, or that there's some kind of problem with that, or they don't have enough land for that, for example. Another common thing with homesteaders might be raising animals or growing vegetables or other food or dairy for their own purposes in an area that might have ordinances that, you know, would regulate noise, that regulate odors, right? That regulate what kinds of things you might have, for example, in your yard. And so you've got people just trying to grow their own food, and then they have a township or a county or a municipality telling them they're in violation of some ordinance because, you know, they want the front lawn to look beautiful. One interesting thing with homesteaders, I'll go ahead and raise one of our examples, is that we're starting to see more urban homesteader members, right? Who are just growing, they're growing on their own land to eat their own food for their own purposes. And then the municipality raises eyebrows. So we had a case in Gary, Indiana, a little bit ago, in which we had a member take, you know, a lot, purchase a new home in Gary, Indiana, and a lot that was probably not very healthy soil. And she started reworking it so that she could work the land for herself to feed her own family. So she was using wood chips, and she was using water jugs to water all of the starter plants. And, you know, the city said she was in violation of some ordinance that prohibited debris or a mess in your front yard. Well, you know, she used mulch and leaves and things that regenerate and heal the soil. And they objected to that. So that's one example, I think, of how homesteaders run into problems with the law. And we were able in that case to finally resolve things with the city. And, you know, now she's doing a lot of good work healing that soil and making her own food.
Yeah, it's like you said, we've had calls where someone is growing food in the front of their yard, and the zoning board or whatever sends them a warning letter. It says they can only grow in the back of their yard.
Yeah,
I think zoning is one of the worst developments. The best looking lawn is a lawn that has food, all kinds of food growing in it. But that's...
Yeah. Hoop houses too, we were having a problem with a couple of cases last year where, you know, if it looked like beautiful, you know, rolling hills in the backyard, that was fine. But if you put up a hoop house so you could extend growing season, that was seen as some kind of a, you know, visual slight or something like that. And it's fascinating because people just growing your own food shouldn't be so complicated, right? Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a good segue to get into some of the litigation FTC, LDF does. I mean, one of the things, there are a lot of times we don't cherry pick cases at all. We just, you know, we have a member who's, say, like a long-standing member who has a precedent we think is important, you know, well, even if it's a lousy fact situation, we'll support them because Yeah, I think the way the organization has approached its work is that there's more than one way to win a case. You can win the court case, a court decision, but sometimes you lose the court decision, but it jumpstarts the legislative process, bill gets passed. You can do that on the administrative level, jumpstart the rulemaking process, get a regulation passed. And yeah, more often than not, I think the other change when you don't get the court decision is the agency will either change its enforcement policy and leave your farmer alone, even though they might have lost in court. That's happened to members of ours because they know we'll be willing to go back to court again if they take another action against the farmer.
Right.
Or, yeah, just change your interpretation of the law. But this, you had a right to farm case in Michigan that had a lot of notice last year and actually the year before. And this is the kind of case where just the litigation works in tandem with the rulemaking process. So if you could go over, just the case, the name of the farm and what happened.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the name of the farm is Hidden Creek. I think it might be Hidden Creek Bay. I apologize. But Hidden Creek Farm in Michigan is what I will share. And what's interesting in the case is the farm in question had been farming a number of acres and selling to consumers for a number of years. And then they had the audacity to hold a sale. And that seems to get people's attention at the local level. And so the township involved in that case filed a public nuisance action against the farmers, claiming that they were in violation of public nuisance violations by having the animals on the property and by growing and having customers come to the property. And a neighbor joined the lawsuit and filed a private nuisance action against the farm. So we took that case up, and this is a good example of it's an individual farm, but we felt it fell into that definition of public interest litigation because it involved an interpretation of a local regulation about how far from your neighbor's home you have to have your livestock facility, right? So the regulation at issue was how far is your livestock facility from the neighbor's home? And the state agency had been interpreting that to mean it's only 250 feet from the barn where the livestock are kept from the neighbor's house. The township and the neighbor said it was 250 feet from the property line. And initially a court agreed with them. So the case had implications for all small farmers throughout the state of Michigan, right? So this was not just a matter of one farmer. And we were in contact with the Michigan Small Farmers Council and other farmers were really watching the case carefully because MDARD, the state agency, the Michigan Department of Ag, interpreted it as from the barn to the neighbor's house had to be 250 feet and Hidden Creek was in compliance prior to the litigation. The regulation was not written crystal clear. So like you said, Pete, it depends more sometimes not on the law, but on the agency's interpretation. So we took on the case. There was initially a temporary restraining order hearing against the farmer. Then there was a hearing on the merits, and we represented the farm through all of those hearings and, you know, legal briefings, et cetera. A court disagreed with MDARD and said that a farmer's property line had to be 250 feet away from the neighbor's house. Now, this was a big change for all small farmers in Michigan, so it impacted not just our member, but, again, farms across Michigan. And so we were in the process of both appealing the decision and we were willing to go through and had started the process of mediation to try to resolve this issue. And at the same time, we were in contact with the state agency and the committee on the state agency got together to make the regulation more clear that the terminology livestock facility meant the physical structure of the barn and not the property line. So MDARD rewrote the legislation or rewrote its regulation to make it clear that this farm is in compliance as long as there's 250 feet between their barn facility, their structure, and the neighbor's house. So it was litigation against the members, and we had used right to farm as a defense. but the court was in disagreement because he saw a nuisance per se. But as we were keeping the case alive in the courts, it became more of a policy resolution, and the state agency clarified its position on it so that we got it resolved, and so that all of those small farms across Michigan are now protected by that legislation. I guess I should be clear that it was a right to farm case, because as long as you're in compliance with the state regulations, the right to farm law gives you the right to farm. So we were fighting about whether this farm was in compliance with this rule about how much space between a livestock facility and the neighbor's house. But it is an example of a case that started from litigation and got resolved as a policy matter to a very good result for small farms across Michigan.
Yeah, and I'd say the Legal Defense Fund successfully negotiated a resolution with the town. So they basically, the litigation with the town was taken care of in court, while this neighbor who was suing the farm, that was taken care of basically by policy, which was spurred on by the litigation, I think. Just one thing for the listeners, these right to farm laws are very important, and Michigan has about the best one. The right to farm laws were originally enacted to protect the CAFOs, just the big confined animal operations that were polluting the land. But they're so broad in some cases, like in Michigan, as long as you're in compliance with these farming regulations, like you said, and have a minimal amount of, I mean, one court said you could sell a dozen eggs and still be protected under the right to farm laws.
That's awesome.
So it's something that was meant to protect the big outfits, protect the small farmer as well. So
yeah, it's really helpful. I agree that they're helpful, even though it wasn't enacted to help small farms. But what's interesting too is where we have right to farm laws, you know, your county or your township folks that are trying to enforce these kind of ordinances are very often unaware, right? And so resolving some of these cases sometimes is as simple as one of our attorneys calling up these local entities, showing them and explaining the right to farm law, and then we can resolve whatever the underlying issue was. And I think we could have even done that in this Michigan case. The township, really, once we started educating them about the right to farm law, was kind of reasonable, but it was this neighbor that continued. And so we had to keep going forward in order to get it clarified.
Right. So, yeah, just one further point of clarification is just what the right to farm law says is no matter what the zoning is, even if it's not zoned for agriculture, if you follow these farming regulations the Michigan Department of Agriculture has issued and have any sales at all, you can be protected under that law. So it's, yeah, we Legal Defense Fund has probably litigated a half dozen right to farm cases in Michigan just because it has the best law and you want to keep the teeth in that law.
Right.
Okay, so that's an example of just being there for a member who gets in trouble. I mean, if either party had been successful in that case, the member would have been out of business, would have had to move elsewhere. But there's also occasionally Legal Defense Fund takes on a proactive case, a broader policy issue. So right now there's currently litigation with FDA over the right to legalize raw butter in interstate commerce. So if you could speak to that litigation.
Sure, I certainly will.
And the background of the case.
Yeah, and I know you were involved in the beginning, Pete, so correct me, but I'll just start out by explaining that the FDA prohibits the sale of raw milk across state lines, and that they interpreted that to include any raw milk products such as raw butter. But it was as a result of prior court litigation, and the FDA never really studied the impact of raw butter or made a decision about the health and safety of raw butter. And that's what led the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund a number of years ago to petition the FDA to find that the interstate sales of raw butter was lawful, right? 3 years went by and the FDA did not bother to respond to the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund petition. So ultimately, we sued the FDA because they failed their obligation under federal law to respond to the citizen's petition. After that litigation, they issued a decision that in fact they were upholding the ban on the interstate sales of raw butter. We then amended our action in federal court to challenge that decision, arguing a couple different things. One, that legally they didn't have the right because of the way the statutes are written. Butter is already defined, so they shouldn't have changed that. But also that their decision was arbitrary and capricious because they didn't have evidence that raw butter was actually, you know, an unsafe product. And in fact, we presented strong evidence that raw butter is a safe product, that it's a product in which pathogens don't grow because of the low moisture and the high fat. So we are still litigating, and I know we'll get into some other details, but we're still litigating this decision of the FDA that I believe came out in February of last year or the year before.
Right, last year.
Yeah, to continuing to prohibit the interstate sale of raw butter. We have fully briefed the issue at this point, which means we've filed all the legal briefs back and forth. I think there may still be an oral argument. But essentially, we are arguing that one, the FDA didn't have the legal authority to do this, and that two, raw butter is a safe and healthy product, and the FDA did not rely upon specific scientific evidence to suggest that raw butter was unsafe in reaching its decision.
What was amazing to me was, like you said, the Legal Defense Fund, and along with Mark McAfee, who's the largest raw dairy producer in the country, filed a petition requesting that FDA issue a rule legalizing the sale of raw butter in interstate commerce. And yeah, like you mentioned, it took over 3 years for them to answer, where really the law requires an answer in 6 months. But the amazing thing was, they issued in their rejection letter, they included this chart that had, I think 13 cases of outbreaks caused by raw butter in over 100-year period. Only, and when you read the data on each outbreak, it's very incomplete with most data. With most of the outbreaks, there was only one outbreak that said for sure it was unpasteurized butter. And it turns out later in the case, FDA said, well, yeah, we included it outbreaks that could have been either raw or pasteurized butter, because a lot of these outbreaks, they just said butter. So it's like, well, FDA, you know, pasteurized butter is legal. This isn't about pasteurized butter. What do you have on raw butter? You know, where are the outbreaks? And the only one they specifically mentioned where they listed raw butter, it was homemade raw butter. There wasn't a single case that they definitively showed commercially produced raw butter made anyone sick. So it's just, if the Legal Defense Fund had submitted a graph like that or a chart like that to FDA, FDA wouldn't have given it the time of day. So.
Yeah, no, this chart is amazing to suggest that the data they're relying on, they say in one of their legal briefs, right, is this history of illness caused by butter, as you said, dating back to the early 1900s, in only one case in that entire chart, like you say, can they say it was raw unpasteurized butter. For some of the early years, it says not specified, but commonly raw, because they weren't pasteurizing in the early 1900s, right? So, but from a scientific standpoint, making presumptions and not having the data, I mean, goodness, I was not a very good science student, and I know you can't do that, right? So pretty amazing stuff. I also want to point out, you did mention it was homemade and not for commercial sale, the one case they had. The one case they had was also back in 02. So it means that since 02, and there was one case in 03 in England, but in this country since 02, they don't have any data or anything to rely on to suggest that raw butter is unsafe. Which says to me that, you know, the producers are taking the care they need and that it is a safe product, right? Because even the one instance they had, I mean, it doesn't feel like 02 was a long time ago, but that was quite a while ago and they have nothing recent to complain of.
Right. And what, so listeners know they enacted this ban based on their power to regulate communicable disease. So if raw butter is a communicable disease, they can ban just about any food under this power. You know, that it's the trouble with these regulations. I mean, I think the evidence clearly favors just overturning FDA's rejection, but the courts give them, the agency, so much deference. It's still, difficult, but for, you know, what FDA is basically saying, when you look at the low incidence of illness from raw butters, they can ban anything. They can ban any food that they want under this power. And it's just a real abuse of their authority to me.
Yeah. And the thing that troubles me the most is that they rely on studies and information relating to fluid raw milk in a lot of cases, but raw butter is different. And there's, they didn't really separate that out for study, right? And so I find that really disturbing because it's a different product with different properties. And in my view, right, if the FDA is going to ban something, then you better well have really good, solid scientific evidence of the health and safety problems with that product, which they just don't have when it comes to raw butter.
Right. So, yeah, both this Hidden Creek farm case and the FDA case are, you mentioned the term earlier, is known as public interest litigation. Yeah, if you could define that for the listeners, please.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would define public interest litigation as litigation that will impact not just the parties, but a group of people. And it really is a way to be changing policy through litigation, right? So even though, like the raw butter petition, for example, this is a proactive piece of legislation. We do have a dairy farm, as you mentioned, Mark McAfee is part of it, but it's public interest in the sense that we are bringing this because we believe it's in the public interest to have available to it healthy and nutritious products, including raw butter. And so we're trying to make this change on behalf of the public, not merely defending one of our members, right, in a local agency matter. So it's through litigation trying to make improvements in policy that benefit the public, or at least a large portion of the public, right? So we do like to engage in that kind of litigation when we can.
Right. So, yeah, it's litigation that's going to affect more than just a member.
Correct.
Before the court. So speaking of policy, yeah, let's go on to some of the policy work Legal Defense Fund has done. And you mentioned just the overriding issue right now just seems to be the lack of slaughterhouse infrastructure and the, you know, past and possibly looming meat shortages in the future. And one remedy for that is, at least partial remedy, is the Prime Act. So if you could talk about that.
Sure. Yes. So like I said, the general rule is that you would have to bring animals to a USDA or state inspected facility in order to sell the meat from those animals. Smaller producers are being given like 2 or 3 years out in terms of when they can get into these facilities. An alternative that we work with our members on is bring animals to custom slaughter facilities. However, that has to be an animal that's owned by, you know, an owner of the animal for their own personal use. You cannot sell the meat from animals that have been brought to custom slaughter. So what the Prime Act would do is allow local producers to use these custom slaughter facilities and then sell the meat that was slaughtered at the custom slaughter and processing facilities. So it would allow states, I think it may be, so that would allow states to allow custom slaughter facilities to be used to sell the meat. And I just want to say, because people may wonder, that custom slaughter facilities are required under federal law to meet stringent standards in terms of sanitation and not producing adulterated food or misbranded food. The only difference is that you don't have an inspector there for each and every slaughter, right? So I know I've heard some pushback to it where people are concerned, well, shouldn't we be regulating meat safety? It's still regulated, probably more so than you and I think it should be. But what the Prime Act would do is allow the use of these custom slaughter facilities where local producers can bring animals and then sell the products rather than have to sell a live animal or a portion of a live animal and then bring it to the processor. That would help these small producers so dramatically, because if the ones that are trying to use USDA and state inspection facilities can't get in, you know, because they're the small guy and the big producers are the ones that are getting the business in there, and they'll go under if they can't afford to maintain a live animal for 2-3 years and not get dates to bring in their animals for slaughter and processing. So it's a real example of how the policy supports the larger producers rather than the smaller ones. And the Prime Act would allow small folk to bring it to customs slaughter facilities and sell their meat.
Right. Just there are a couple federal laws that are very problematic for people at the state level because they preempt the field of state regulation. The states have to adhere to the federal standards. And number one on the list is the Federal Meat Inspection Act, because that, what the Prime Act would do would be amended as you've described. Really, it seems like, the Legal Defense Fund, when it comes to policy, is mainly worked at the state level, because it seems, the federal level, just more lobbyists representing the big producers. At the local level, you get a lot of these NIMBY, not my backyard attitudes sometimes. So it seems like the state level is a place where we can make the most progress. So if you could talk about just some of the work done in the state legislatures.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just say that we're seeing a lot of it right now because the early part of the year is when a lot of the state legislatures are active. But so, yes, I think we're getting the attention of state legislators, particularly in light of some of the meat processing problems that we've seen post-COVID. And I'll just say that just illuminated the problems, right? They already existed. But a few things that we're seeing at the state level are what we call Food Freedom Acts. And that would be to lessen regulations of smaller producers. So in general, that might mean you don't have need a license for certain foods. It may specifically provide for food production in areas that were previously regulated. And the ones that the meat production that we're seeing, Nebraska and Colorado and Montana, I believe, do have pending potential state laws that would make it more clear that you can have these meat share agreements. And I don't know the exact details of each of them off the top of my head, but they would make it easier in the state for a local producer to produce meat animals and then slaughter and process the animals and get it directly to the consumer. So the one current existing food freedom law that's really good on meat is the Wyoming statute. And that one says the end consumer owns a share of that herd. They can purchase that, but then they can pay the producer, the farmer, to provide them with a specific cut of meat as opposed to, just getting a share of the animal. So I think that there may be similar language in the Nebraska statute and the Colorado statute. Pete, you and I spoke yesterday on Montana. I think you have a little bit better handle on that state. And we'll probably get to some of the other subjects, but in general, what I'll just say is Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund will send out action alerts on these policies. We will find members that are interested and involved, sometimes providing for testimony at the state legislator level as we try to push through these policies, sometimes just educating folks like I recently did in Colorado, really explaining the Federal Meat Inspection Act and why this is so important to make it easier at the state level. So there's a lot of ways that we can get involved in supporting some of this legislation.
Right. And also, that would include sometimes a development and possibly even drafting, the Legal Defense Fund worked on the development of the Prime Act with lead sponsor, Representative Thomas Massey. Yeah, we've worked on drafting other legislation. Yeah, I kind of break it down to just the local food legislation into, I'd say five categories. One is the cottage foods, where just certain what are called foods not subject to time and temperature control, you can sell with little or no regulation. And raw milk is kind of a category in itself because there's an interstate ban. The states are free more with that food than any other food to write the laws and regulations they want. Then there's these favorable, the custom exemption you were talking about, adopting the federal regulation on the custom exemption for uninspected meat. And then on-farm poultry processing, again, adopting the federal. Yep. And then last is these food freedom bills, which allows the sale, not only the sale of foods not subject to time and temperature control, but many foods subject to time and temperature control. And that's Wyoming was the first one really to do that. And Montana actually has a bill that passed out of the Senate yesterday. So, yeah, they're just several other states have done that. But when you look at some of these other bills, the cottage foods, almost every single state has a cottage foods bill. Raw milk, I'd say in, almost 45 states now, the producers can legally produce raw milk for human consumption. Some of the states are open to interpretation, but with the custom slaughter exemption, the on-farm poultry processing, most states have adopted those. So it's, getting down to these food freedom bills, expanding the sales that can be sold, because it's kind of counterintuitive. Really, the less regulation there is at the local level, I think the safer food is going to be. Because these producers have plenty of incentive to produce safe food. If there's one illness, it's not like some big corporation where it's the cost of doing business. They're done at the local level. So it's just something where you see the progress that's being made. There's a lot more that can be made. So on the one hand, you're proactive, just trying to push more to deregulate. And on the other hand, because of what's going on the federal level, sometimes you have to fight these rear guard actions, just trying to protect what people have earned in the various states already. And there's actually a regulation after the Food Federal Meat Inspection Act, the worst federal food law, the one that's the most harmful to our members, I'd say, would be the Food Safety Modernization Act. And they're... it just seems like it's designed to paperwork people to death. And there was actually a law that was a regulation pursuant to the Food Safety Modernization Act that was issued recently. And I know Legal Defense Fund commented on that. So if you could talk about that and give people an idea of some of the...
So... Before I get into FSMA and the FDA traceability rule, which is what you're getting at, I just want to say so that a third way that we can get involved in policy is when agencies change a regulation, they often have to publish it, and there's something called notice and comment, where they are required by law, whether it's state agency or federal agency, to allow the public to comment on a proposed regulation. And so that is one thing that we've done a couple of times. We'll probably continue to do more and more. I know we've done it some in some of the local legislation in Texas recently. I did one, I at least wrote to legislators in South Dakota trying to support a cottage food bill there. It's another way that we can get involved in policy. FSMA generally, I would, in a lot of the federal laws that talk about food safety, I think it's such an example of how we're writing a law to make sure that food is safe that's produced at these huge, large levels, right? I mean, and I'm digressing a little, but bear with me. You know, you pasteurize milk because you've got hundreds of products coming in from all over and you can't ensure that safety. But at the small producer level, you can. But policy doesn't pay enough attention, I would say, to our smaller sustainable farms. And instead, you know, we're just passing what for a small farm is really onerous record-keeping requirements. So FSMA, the Food Safety Modernization Act, was passed several years ago, and it does have some exemptions for smaller producers. It's not as broad of an exemption as I would like, but it does have some exemptions in terms of some of the training requirements or sanitation requirements. There are record-keeping requirements. Again, the smallest producers were usually fell under an exemption, but there was kind of this middle ground which was between $25,000 and $500,000 of revenue, in which they had to meet certain requirements, but maybe not necessarily all of the things in FSMA. In any case, you know, we've now reached the point where all of the requirements of FSMA, which again require some training, have certain sanitation requirements, certain, you know, separation of animals from crops, that kind of thing, all of those regulations have now kicked into gear and should just be operating. And then in the meantime, what happened, and it initially came out late last year, I think September of last year, the FDA issued one of these proposed rules called the FDA Traceability Act, where it's requiring producers to keep, not just to keep records of what they're doing in their fields, but to keep records in a certain format and to keep details that are really, really onerous. And so two things that I really object to with the FDA traceability rule is, one, it doesn't have that middle exemption between 25,000 and 500,000. It only has the super, super small producers are exempt from the act. The other big problem I have with it is the record keeping requirements. It actually says, so if the FDA shows up at your farm and wants to see the records of the crops that have been grown and sold and who they've been sold to and how long they were kept and exactly where they were grown, you need to provide that to the FDA in a spreadsheet form, including the GPS coordinates of where the
crops. Yeah, it's unbelievable.
And so, I mean, this, I picture our small members, particularly our small members, very involved with regenerative agriculture, who's, if you can even call it a crop, because it's such small production sometimes, but, you know, they rotate, right? And so not only do you not, they may not even have access to the GPS coordinates, so figuring that out could be tough, but even if they did, they would change from year to year because they're trying to keep the soil healthy, and, you know, that's not something they're doing on those huge monocrops, right? So very clearly written for large producers, and yet we're included. And we did, the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund did file comments objecting to the new rule, you know, with the federal government, and now it's still pending. But I know that, you know, several of our allies filed comments as well. And this one really just, yeah, the record keeping requirements for a producer doing, you know, any kind of decent volume are just really onerous. And yeah, I guess your phrase of record keeping or papering to death is really what this one's on, right? So, and the purpose supposedly is to be able to trace. Well, okay, fine. You can ask smaller producers to keep records of what they've grown and where they've sold it, but you don't need the level of detail and the GPS coordinates, the depth of detail in which they're going to tell farmers how to keep records under this proposed rule is really onerous.
It just seems like it's designed to put small producers out of business by driving them crazy.
Yeah.
What's interesting is I was at a food safety conference a year or two ago, and there was a high-level FDA official who spoke, and he said the Achilles heel of the food safety system is traceability. What's more traceable than locally produced food?
Right.
So what they're doing with this regulation is they're putting the most traceable aspect of the food safety system out of business right now.
Right.
So it's, yeah, I always thought it, the purpose of FSMO really was to consolidate the food supply in fewer hands in this country.
Yeah. And
I think this is definitely going to do it. One last part on the policy, though. A lot of times, and sometimes this is because of what happens to Legal Defense Fund farmers, show there's a weakness in the law and the agency interprets the law differently. Yeah, if you could talk about just what happened in South Carolina recently with the custom slaughter, because that's a good idea of how the law in effect, maybe not on paper, but in effect changes favorably sometimes.
Yeah, thank you. It's an example of actually what you said earlier in terms of how the agency interprets a law can be much more important than necessarily what you see when you look the law up, right? In this area of state and local regulation in particular. So South Carolina has one of the most restrictive custom slaughter state laws in the country, in my opinion. And what it appears to say, which frankly, it's not very clear. I know when I first had to read through it, it was pretty confusing, but it sounds like the previous interpretation of the law was that a producer could use custom slaughter for their own animals. So if I have, you know, beef cattle, if I have goats or what have you, I can bring my own animals to the custom slaughter facility, have them slaughtered and processed, but can only use that meat for the producers, for my own family and my invited non-paying guests, right? So it's really just for the producer's personal use. Most states allow for the producer's personal use, but a lot goes further and allow for owners to purchase animals and then bring them to custom slaughter. In any case, the interpretation for years of the South Carolina law appears to only be for producer's use. And we had a member of our staff recently try to clarify the South Carolina law with the local authorities. And they said, in light of the crisis that we're seeing with producers not being able to get into these USDA and state inspection facilities, they will interpret the law as allowing for a producer to sell a live animal or a portion of a live animal to a new owner, and for that new owner to now be able to have the animal slaughtered and processed for their own use. This is the law in many states, but it has not been the law in South Carolina. And so, you know, we were really focusing on making sure our red meat map information on our website was accurate, because this is like everyone's number one top priority at the moment. And you have to actually sometimes confirm it with the local agencies because the law is not at all clear. And in this case, the state agency seems to be saying, look, in light of the fact that people can't get things to slaughter, we are interpreting our law to allow for end consumers to purchase a live animal or part of an animal, have it custom processed, and be able to get meat in that fashion. So this is a big win, right? This is our communicating with state agencies, pushing them on, you know, the interpretation and pointing out why the previous interpretation is so limiting to producers and will drive producers out of business. So yeah, we felt that's a really helpful interpretation for our South Carolina producers who now can help end users get local meat. So it was a pretty exciting development.
Okay, well, the purpose of this broadcast is to get support from the Legal Defense Fund. Just one thing I'll say before I ask you about membership is, yeah, FTCLDF is a true grassroots organization. It's never taken a dime from any government agency. As far as I know, it's never taken any money from any big corporations either. It's been mostly small corporations of like mind. And so the bulk of its revenues come from individual donations and membership fees. So if you could tell the listeners what people get for membership first. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And yes, our main sources of revenue are definitely our member fees and then individual donations. And it's so important that we get the donations because member fees won't necessarily on their own support litigation like the Michigan case we discussed.
Right.
We need to keep the membership low so that the smaller producers that are really struggling can be members and be represented. But what you get for membership is we do have different levels. And so for the farmer and the food artisan level membership and an affiliate membership, which may be like a small, you know, retailer buying club scenario, in the first 6 months, you'll get a couple of hours of representation. And after that, pretty much unlimited legal consult. We will often, depending on the case, also provide legal representation in litigation to the individual. And so that's not a given, but in many, many cases, we will provide legal representation under the circumstances to the members. We do have a consumer membership level that I think is also really important. And it's really to support changing our food system so that consumers can also get a hold of these locally healthy produced foods. So having consumer members support the organization and saying, I want to support those small growers so that I can, as a consumer, go out to the farm and get healthy products from someone that I know, talk about traceability, right, as opposed to some other source. And so the legal representation for farmers and food producers is a major benefit of the organization. Knowing that we are working on and supporting these policy efforts to attempt to level the playing fields, to allow producers to get food of their choice to consumers' hands, also very important. And we do regularly keep everybody informed of developments, so policy developments. We have resources on our website. We have webinars on both legal issues and more practical issues for small farms. You know, so there's a real host of benefits to being a member or supporting the organization. You know, I guess I'll just say that as a general rule, I just see it as if we can support the small food producer, small farmer, that's working towards changing our food system back to a more decentralized system where we can get food that we can trust from local producers. That's really the name of the game, right? We happen to do it through legal representation and policy work, but that's what the organization is ultimately trying to do with its support.
Yeah, well, just One thing I'd say about just the farmer members, the homesteaders, they not only get unlimited consultation after 6 months, if the Legal Defense Fund does agree to represent them when they have a, say, a judicial or administrative hearing, yeah, frequently there's no cost to them beyond their membership fee.
That's correct. No, and we've had a number of agency hearings in the last year or so, and we just provide a lawyer that represents the member free of charge, and we represent them through that hearing. We will at times also represent them through a court proceeding. There may be instances, but frankly, they've been, you know, more rare than the opposite, where we wouldn't take on a specific legal case. But for the most part, yeah, we're there to provide the legal representation.
Right. And just people wondering where the money is going, a lot of it just goes towards setting up an attorney network around the country. So, yeah, you could briefly discuss that.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, we have a few folks that work on a daily basis with us, but for the most part, we're going to, particularly if we're going to hearing or signing off on contracts, we're going to need local counsel all across the country to be involved with us. And so a good portion of our funds that are spent will either be on outside attorneys doing litigation for us or on our attorney network that will, other attorneys that we will need to use periodically, either to approve things or to represent a member. So we do have this network to go to when we have members with legal problems across the country. I do really want to emphasize something here, which is that I think we do a very good job, and I'm very fortunate and grateful to our attorneys who are part of that network, because they often charge us very low rates. So I want to be clear that it's not like we're collecting money and then paying high-priced lawyers, right? The attorneys helping us also believe in the mission and are trying really, we get a decent amount of pro bono work done as well. But there's certain things you really do need to pay outside counsel for, and that's where a lot of our fees go. But at very reasonable rates to people who are just supporting the mission.
Right. You mentioned the webinars earlier. So if you could just talk, give an example or two about what people would get for your discounted webinars.
Yeah, well, what we started last year for the first time is what we're calling members-only webinars. It's another thank you and sort of boost for being a member of ours, and we're trying to hit topics that really serve and help our members. So we've done two webinars so far on farm marketing, right? So learning techniques to continue growing a small farm, staying viable, finding new customers, and really growing your business. So, you know, that's not legal, but it's something that I think that our members appreciate. But we've also had, you know, webinars that were more directed to the law. So some details on poultry processing, for example. We had Dr. Mike Fisher review some poultry processing exemption laws with us as a webinar not that long ago. And we also did host a webinar on raw butter so that people understood, if they were interested, could attend the webinar and really get a better handle on why we feel strongly about the health and safety of raw butter. Not necessarily all these legal aspects you and I were talking about, but why it's a good product, right? So that's what we've done so far. We're still working. We'll have another one up in April. I'm not sure the order of things, so I'm going to hold off saying what we'll have coming up. But we think this will be a quarterly offering to just members to have these webinars, education webinars.
Right. And yeah, just you've also had webinars on marketing for farmers.
Yeah. Yeah. Correct. Sorry, I thought I said that one. But yeah, marketing for farmers so that they can grow their business and sort of keep their customers.
Right.
Find new customers, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, just Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund is protecting your sources of real food. And just with the current state of the food system, this is just an organization. I think it's more important than ever for people to support. If you just look, I mean, just the last 3 or 4 months, I've heard that USDA is looking to lift the label disclosure requirement on irradiated poultry and meat. They're working towards approval, FDA and USDA, I think, even though they haven't said for sure, of this cell cultured meat. Food safety conference I was at recently, one of the speakers talked about meat replacements mealworms, crickets, and termites. So this is just the conventional system is moving to this synthetic food. So it's just the better sources for real food are increasingly going to be found in the local system. And that's the Legal Defense Fund's job to protect the producer's ability to make those foods and the consumer's ability to have access to the foods. So that's kind of my pitch. What is your elevator speech if someone asks you about FDC-LDF?
Yeah, well, thanks, Pete. I think my short elevator speech, so to speak, would I too think that just as an organization, we're primed right now. Consumers want small, locally produced, healthy, and like you said, real food, right? But the policies and the regulatory structures that are in place favor larger producers and make it really difficult for the small producers to remain viable. So what our organization does is provide the representation, which could be an agency hearing, it could be a negotiation, it could be setting up a contract, it could be a consultation, but we provide that legal representation. And I'll add that these consultations, you know, will get to people pretty quickly. You know, so for example, Pete, I just want to thank you because you immediately, whenever I say call this member, they have a meat processing question or a poultry processing question, I know you're getting back to them quickly. And that's true of all of us that are working with our members, that you get the answers you need quickly, these producers. We're there to represent you and help you through when there's a crisis, like an inspector at the farm gate. Like somebody accusing a farm of an illness from raw milk, we're there to represent that member. And we're there to try to change policy so that it's easier for smaller producers to be able to get food that consumers want to the consumers without this regulatory burden.
Okay, so final questions. How do people join or donate? And if they want more information, how do they... About FTC-LDF, how do they get it?
So the best place to just get information, I would say, is our website, which is farmtoconsumer.org. We are on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram as well. But the website is farmtoconsumer.org. And you can join at any membership level online. You can also donate online. Very nice and convenient. Those of you at Solari, you know, there's also something if you were to choose to donate that asks how you learned about us. And it's nice to know that you heard of us from Catherine Fitz and from Solari. So if you wanted to let us know that. You also could always call for those that don't like doing online. And the phone number is 1-703-FARM or...
That's 703-208-3276.
Right. And so either online or calling us to support it, we're always so grateful. It really means a lot to us to get the support to represent these small farmers and producers and homesteaders.
Yeah, I'd like to thank Solari for the members for the support they've given the Legal Defense Fund so far. Hopefully those who haven't joined or donated yet, this podcast will help you see the importance of the work that Farm to Consumer does. And Alexia, appreciate your time and best of success.
Yeah, well, thank you so much, Pete, for having me and for Solari for having us. It really, as Pete said, we're grassroots and finding the people who understand that this system is rigged against the smaller producers who are producing the food that we're told, right, that consumers want. And so any support, even paying attention to policy and calling your legislators on policy issues, we greatly appreciate.
All right. Take care, Alexia.
Thanks. Take care.